you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This is Joe Cordell, and with me today is Susan Arthur. I think you're going to love the topic today. The topic today relates to bone health, and we know the risks of fracture and the pain and stuff associated with bone issues as we age. We know that this topic is going to be of great practical value and interest for those of you who are over 60. So, Susan, tell us more about our guest today.
I know you are going to love our guest today. He is Dr. Andrew Spitzfaden, and he graduated from the University of Missouri Columbia Medical School and completed his orthopedic surgery internship and residency at St. Louis University Hospital. He's a St. Louis guy. Dr. Spitzfaden has presented orthopedic surgery topics to local organizations such as Lutheran Senior Services, St. Louis Suburban School of Nurses Association, senior church groups, and St. Luke's Girls Night Out events, where he has fielded questions and common female orthopedic conditions. He's also written for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on dealing with prevention and management of hip fractures in the aging population. So thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Doctor. And I want to, where do we start? I want to talk a little bit about, to begin, osteopenia, for example. I've been hearing more about this. I turned 60 recently, and I was told that my doctor told me that I have this mild osteopenia, and for me not to be worried about it, but it's something they need to watch. So suddenly I have an interest in this topic. Now, this isn't the only reason, incidentally, doctor, you're here today.
I had no idea, and I set up the interview.
It was an alternative to a doctor's appointment. In any case, so let's start out talking a little bit about that, and then we can move on to other bone issues that are going to be of a special concern to people as they age.
Okay. Sounds good.
So tell me, what is osteopenia?
So, you know, osteopenia basically means that your bone is thinning somewhat. Everyone's going to have a certain degree of osteopenia as we age, and there's ways to kind of test that, and there's scans that you can get. And there's, you know, they actually apply a number to the amount of osteopenia that you have, and if it reaches a certain point, then that's when you're diagnosed with osteoporosis. And all this means is that you're more susceptible to fractures and injuries with lower impact or lower energy falls, as opposed to when you were, 22 years old and your bone was, there was no thinning yet of your bone.
So is this something that you would recommend that at a certain age that everyone be tested to see if their bone thickness or density is what it needs to be?
Yeah, and usually your primary care doctors, that's why routine follow-up is important, but they will test it, depending on your family history, maybe if you've had a symptom, if a patient has had a fall and had a fracture, their primaries may initiate the testing to see if they have osteoporosis or what level of osteopenia so that maybe medicine could be started. And those are managed by the primary care doctors.
So they wouldn't do this automatically as you age, like you get a colonoscopy, for example. This is something that you would look for some signals that there's an issue.
No, I believe that, most primary doctors will do it, I believe, after the age of 60. I'm pretty sure that's when they'll do it. But they're routinely done. And some people have, are doing great. And then, they might get it every few years.
I know women. Yeah. I think it's pretty routine for women.
Women especially, because mm-hmm. they have a higher degree of bone loss because of going through the menopause.
Oh, really?
It all has to do with hormones and whatnot.
So for people who are concerned about bone thickness or bone health in this way, should they be doing some sort of high-impact exercise, or what do you suggest?
So, the best advice that we give patients and when they ask about this is we if a patient's 60, 70, even 80 years old and they're in good medical health, we do recommend always implementing a low impact type, cardio program, whether it's just getting out and walking. Obviously in St. Louis, there's days where you're not going to go outside and walk. So we say, go to the mall, join a gym and maybe do a treadmill. Elliptical, anything like that, where you're stimulating or where your joints are moving, helps bone health, and it will help to keep the bones strong. obviously some things, no matter what you do, the body just, you know, you may develop osteoporosis or penia, but there's ways, you know, certainly to help prevent it by activities. And that's what, as orthopedic surgeons, that's what our job is, to try to guide patients. And then there's the medication side, which, you know, the primaries may implement as well in some cases.
Now, is it safe to say, though, that as an orthopedic surgeon, that really you're the guy who kind of comes in when maybe those precautionary things didn't work? Not that you know, are not an authority on those things, and that's part of what we're going to draw upon here. But I'm just curious about the role of the surgeon versus the bone health practitioner generally.
I mean, so, well, we will see a lot of patients. I mean, obviously our practices are, patients come in when they have pain or they've had an injury, and we meet them, whether it's from the emergency room call or whatnot. But in that discussion or in those appointments, you develop a relationship with your patients, and a lot of them, then you start talking about things that they can do as far as preventative measures for osteopenia or osteoporosis. So we definitely try to play a role, and it's kind of, you know, we're kind of trained and taught that we should be proactive in helping patients, especially our elderly patients, in preventing some of these problems, because obviously we definitely get involved when an injury happens, you know, especially in, let's say, a woman who's, you know, 60 years old or and doesn't know she has any sign and she has a low energy injury and breaks her wrist, you know, and that's when we may say, you know, I think this, you may want to talk to your primary and get the bone, you know, the scan in order to assess the strength of your bones. And we can kind of kickstart that for the patient.
Does this sometimes show up as a hip fracture?
Absolutely. And that's one of the biggest, that's probably the biggest risk. And that's the most, you know, that's one of the injuries that carries a high degree of complications, especially for patients when they get, you know, when they, for the elderly patients. The hip, and that's one of the areas they'll assess when you do the scan to look for osteopenia, because when you fall on a hip, again, as a kid, you're just going to bounce right back up, but you have a low impact fall just onto your side and you're 80 years old, I mean, a hip fracture is very common.
And explain this. I've heard that often a fractured hip, and I don't want to be dramatic here, but that often the result for people at the end of the process is maybe a fatality for people when they have a fractured hip at a certain age. Explain how that progresses from a fractured hip to people having a high probability at certain ages. I don't want to alarm our listeners.
Right.
Yeah. At certain ages, it can result in death. Explain that.
No, that's a great question. It's basically if an elderly person who's, you know, 80 years old or an 85 has a hip fracture, it creates obviously it's a painful injury. And so first of all, our goal is, you know, we don't wait a week or 2 weeks to get this thing fixed. I mean, we want to fix the hip within usually 48 hours if we can, and we can get clearance medically to proceed with surgery. The reason is we need to get them up and get them moving, because the complications after a hip fracture, which could include just lying in bed, immobility, you know, blood clots on the legs, pneumonias can develop, bed sore, I mean, the complications, and then those can lead into just a downward spiral of complications and issues, which can lead to, you know, fatality. So there is, you know, there, especially in patients maybe with like severe dementia, more elderly patients, it all has to do with more your physiologic age, not just the number age, but yeah, mortality within the first year is always a big concern.
So it's not directly the fracture of the hip itself.
Correct. Yeah, it's not that you fall and that bone does something. It's the sequela of what happens because of the fall.
Thereafter.
And you may get the hip fixed and the fracture may heal, but it's just the what can happen over the next 6 months to a year, and just how your life changes because you're not walking properly or just, you know, yeah. And it's a big stress on the system.
Well, and it is often, it's painful to walk, so people avoid it.
Exactly. They don't,
I mean,
walk.
It is
not
the
just
whole
bounce
thing,
back up. Even
right.
If you fix it, they, you know. So,
yeah,
yes.
You've got to like kind of force yourself to do that. And sometimes when you're 80 or 85, you just don't want to do it. And
yes.
And then because of a fear of another fall,
right.
They will often shuffle.
Yes.
Right.
And so, which in some ways increases the chance of falling again,
mm-hmm.
but in any case diminishes their motion, their yes. range of motion and their motion generally.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Motion, confidence. I have a personal situation with a grandmother that fell and broke her hip, and that was the situation. Just never regained confidence and kind of was And it was never the same after, and passed away, you know, probably within a year or so of the injury. So, but yeah, I mean, so on a personal level and professional, we see it all the time. While we can fix things, and our goal is to get the fracture fixed in a way that it'll heal quickly, but that they can really get up. And every fracture of the hip area, the hip, it represents kind of an area, and there's different ways we fix certain kinds of hip fractures. Some hip fractures are fixed with maybe a hip replacement. Some are fixed with, you know, a plate and screws. Some are fixed with a pin and a rod. So it just really depends. And so the goal is to get it fixed and get it moving.
So a hip replacement, I've heard of this surgery, and apparently, at least with younger people, it's a very successful surgery, right? High rates of success?
Yes, when you do a hip replacement on a patient, you know, well, really, yeah, especially the younger patients, or
under
even a patient
60.
That's 70 or 80, for a hip replacement, when a patient comes in electively for arthritis of the hip, and we decide to proceed with the hip replacement based on the fact that their primary doctor says that they are, you know, medically fit to go through it, patients can do wonderfully. It's a great surgery, and patients are very happy, and the quality of life can really improve. When you have a hip fracture, an unexpected event like that, and it's just the trauma and everything is different, and the outcomes even after that kind of hip replacement is can be different. So, yes.
So we're talking to Dr. Andrew Spitzfaden, who's an orthopedic surgeon. So would it ever make sense for somebody who has been told that they're vulnerable to a hip fracture because of maybe osteopenia, osteoporosis even, to, in a preemptive way, to get a hip replacement?
No, I mean, probably not, because, you know, there are risks with surgery. So and then the other side of that is, even if you do have a hip replacement, you can still fall, obviously, and the complications of a fracture around the metal of a hip replacement is even more difficult to deal with. So you do see patients come in that have fractured around their implant or their the metal part of the total hip, and that's even a worse complication. So, yeah, so you don't want to just do it as a preventative type thing.
Kind of to shift gears a little bit, I hear a lot of people in their, let's say, early 60s or 70s that are doing the knee replacements. We've talked a little bit about the hip replacements.
Yeah.
Seems like joint, you know, knee replacements are becoming much more common.
And I keep hearing good things of everybody I know that's had them.
Well, someone described it to me as the best worst thing I've ever done.
Yeah, that's a good way to...
The best worst thing.
The first few days.
The first few days were pretty brutal.
They don't like their doctor the first few days.
So. Pretty brutal.
Yes.
But then they managed to kind of get life back on track with life.
Yes. I mean, the knee replacements, just talking about the knees, and the hips are probably one of my more favorite things to do, because patients, their quality of life when they've decided to proceed is just so affected, and their quality of life is just not what they want it to be. They can't play golf. They can't go on walks. They can't do simple things. And when they, if the knee or the hip replacement goes well, which the high percentage do, and they get through that initial few weeks where, yes, you've got, you know, the pain is managed, but patients, you know, do well. When they hit that point where they really feel good, it is the best thing to see a patient when they come in and they just give you a hug because their knee feels great. And you see them, then they can improve their cardiovascular or, you know, fitness or their heart fitness, because then they're out walking more.
Mm-hmm.
So we help the quality of life, hopefully, and then that will help their quantity of life. So, you know, it can be a neat thing. That's one thing I liked about the field of orthopedics.
Mm-hmm. So describe who is the ideal candidate for, maybe you need to speak about those two surgeries separately, but who would you say generally would be an ideal candidate for those procedures?
So, like for a knee replacement, I mean, you like patients to be 50 and over is great. I mean, we are doing patients younger and younger, even in their 40s, because patients are more active now, and we're seeing just a lot of cases, and the results of surgeries have become even better. The implants are better. So, you know, the ideal patient would be, let's say, just to put a number on, 50 or above. You know, and then it's really important to, you know, the biggest thing is to really evaluate their medical status. I mean, you can have someone who's 50, but whose physiologic age is, you know, that of an 85-year-old, you know, or an unhealthy, whatnot. I've replaced knees. I had the oldest one was a 95-year-old gentleman who went through his medical tests, and he just sailed through it. And
95?
And he said, I want to do this. And we talked and talked, and he has done fantastic. That was about 3 years ago, and he's 98.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, it just goes to show there. Yes, that was, we had to really do a lot of, you know, talking with his primary. But the point is, you know, if you want someone who's healthy, who can undergo it, they always get their heart checked and EKG, and they'll get blood work, and their primary doctors will usually kind of sign off, or I say give us the green light that it's a go. So you work as a team with their primary care doctors. And but if I have a patient, there are patients in their upper 30s that have bad arthritis, and that's where you get in the tough situation where you really want them to try to manage the pain with conservative treatments as long as possible.
Because how long do knee replacements, joint replacements anyway, last? I mean, do they wear out? I guess they do at some point.
Yeah, so there's always, with the knee, there's a plastic component, and that's can be the source of some of the, when they do start to fail, then probably 15 to 20 years is what I can kind of tell patients. I mean, the implants that we're putting in now are even better than they were 15 years ago, so you hope that maybe the new studies will come out and we'll see 25 years. But, you know, you do see patients come into your office that had a knee replacement 20 years ago before I was even in practice, and I'm like, it looks great, you know, so you do see that. But you just have to be prepared if you're, you know, 50, you know, you don't want to count on a knee replacement lasting 30 years. So you do want to just, you want to do it when you just can't take it anymore. And mm-hmm. I use the expression, you wave the white flag. You're like, I just need to do this.
So that the materials you're using now, though, you don't think have the potential for 20 plus years. Is it not fundamentally better than, say, the material that was used 20 years ago?
No, I think it definitely is. We just don't have the study. You know,
you don't
we won't
have
know
the data.
Until. So right now we're gathering data for patients that had their knees put in,
right.
know, 15, 20, you know, so, but, you know, this is what the engineers and, you know, there's so much that goes into it. It's not just a piece of metal and a piece of plastic like you have, you know, on your table or something. I mean, the way that this whole, these implants are designed and manufactured is unbelievable, and so it's really amazing. So the goal is for them to last with as much wear as they're going to get and as much motion that you're going to put it through, that you don't want that plastic to wear down and cause the metal to loosen. So that would be, you know, one reason why things could fail. And then there's, you know, then you have to worry about other reasons like early infections and things like that. There's always risks with these surgeries, but.
So being cautious, as doctors notoriously are.
Hopefully. That's right.
To a flaw, in my opinion. but you're not prepared to tell someone that they should count on 20 plus years. But it sounds like, as you describe this newer material, that somebody who had this surgery at age 60 might reasonably expect 20 plus
if
years.
If life expectancy is, you know, early 80s for men, I believe. Yeah, I mean, I say, you know, there's a chance. I say, absolutely. I mean, I would never, you know, guarantee it. But, you know, if in 15 years they start to have some pain, you got to think about that. Okay, maybe you're starting to, maybe the metal is starting to loosen a little bit. And it doesn't mean it's loosening to the point where it's, you know, shifting. It's more of a micro loosening. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, 60 is a good age to do a knee replacement if the patient is ready for it.
Are there certain things that you should or shouldn't do to kind of prolong the life of a knee replacement or a hip replacement?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you try to recommend low impact activities. I mean, if I have had some patients that like to do some running, and I've got a couple of patients who do a little more high velocity sports. So I got one guy who has had both knees replaced. He's probably 55. And he racquetball, and I'm just,
jeez.
It makes me cringe, but he is doing so well, and he knows. I'm like, you're really
racquetball.
I mean,
that
a lot of motion, you know, and but that's
and
a little extreme. But you know, most patients, when they get this, they're prepared that they're going to be, you know, swimming, elliptical, they can play golf. You could even do, you know, some light snow skiing if you're good and not doing a lot of heavy moguls or something. But patients can be active. So yeah, we want them to be, but it's the high impact running or starting a jog. Don't start a jogging career. Don't start running track with this. There's no reason, you know. Use the knee, but don't abuse the knee.
So the issue then is, it's like with the car. The issue is not the age; it's the mileage.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, that's right.
Okay. So What about weight? Is weight an issue when you're making deciding whether to do the procedure?
A good question. Yeah, the failure rate is much higher for patients whose BMI is 40 or above. So if we have a patient 40 or above, so it's a good size patient, and a lot of them, those are the ones that sometimes will come in with bad arthritis.
And you
have to talk to them and really. As many times you say, if you're trying to do the right thing, we just can't do this until you lose some weight. We can manage it with other conservative treatment things. And I have many patients that do lose the weight, and they come back and they say, I'm down to 250 pounds, and it all relates to your height and weight and all that. But weight definitely plays a role, really, not only just with the failure of the implant, but also other complications that can occur because of morbid obesity like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Risk factors in the surgery itself.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you've got other things, pneumonia, blood clots, infections, I mean, things like that if you're morbidly obese and you have a knee replacement.
Okay. So, but all this, though, and we'll go on and talk about a couple other things related to bone health, but I think that the news generally is that people as they age, there's a lot of new developments that are really encouraging. I mean, that their grandparents, could not have counted on. I mean, the idea of hips and knees is just a radical thing that many of us tend to take for granted because we've heard of it, for the last 15 mm-hmm. years.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So what other things are on the horizon, or in fact maybe newly developed discoveries or methodologies that people have for solutions to pain as they age, especially of course related to bone. I know that osteoarthritis maybe stands out as, would you say, the number one source of pain as people age in their bones?
If it's not number one, it's definitely up there. I mean, everyone develops a certain amount of osteoarthritis, and osteoarthritis again is defined as the wear and tear kind of arthritis. There's other kinds of arthritis like mm-hmm. rheumatoid and things like that are kind of different animals.
That's
an autoimmune disease, which is treated differently. But the osteoarthritis is very common. Everybody will get a little bit of it. Finger joints, you can get it in your neck, your back, your hips. I mean, anywhere, any joint you have, you can get a little bit of osteoarthritis. Some patients just are genetically predisposed to have some more, and it is one of the biggest sources of pain that a patient. Well, that's one of our. That's what we see. It's the biggest thing we see in the office as far as volume.
So this develops though as a result of just the friction of wear and tear over years.
Kind of wear and tear. I mean, there are risk factors that can happen during your life or things that you can do during your life that increase the risk of developing it. Such as if you were a kid and you had a bad fracture around your knee joint, and the fracture involved the cartilage. While it can be fixed and kids can do well later in life, you prepare them that they could have earlier osteoarthritis. People that have had ligament reconstructions or tears at an earlier age, because their knee is not anatomically quote unquote normal anymore, later in life they can be more at risk for developing osteoarthritis. And we see that. I mean, patients come in and they've had a big ligament reconstruction mm-hmm. back in the mid 80s, and you look at the knee and it's just really bad bone on bone by the time they're 50 years old. So,
well, and that's what makes the pain, right? With the bone on bone, it's kind of scraping because the cartilage is worn down.
Exactly. I describe it to my patients as the cushion is gone. The treads of the tire are gone. I mean, there's a lot of good analogies, but the cartilage, which is the cushion, is basically diminished. So when we, for instance, will do knee scopes where we actually go in there and look at tears, I mean, sometimes you can look at the knee and you just see that the cartilage is just completely worn down and there's already bone coming through in certain spots. And then when we do some of these patients for knee replacements, when you look at the actual knee, I mean, it's unbelievable how much there's just no cartilage in some of these knees. And it's hard to believe that patients could walk mm-hmm. at all. But yeah, it's the bone on bone and that contact that results in the pain.
So the osteoarthritis, though, would also tend to affect people more who've had occupations where there were certain types of physical activity, people who may have been lifting in warehouses or...
Yeah. Professional football player lineman or something. People who are just operating a jackhammer in a street crew for 30 years. I mean, no doubt. I mean, if having a sedentary lifestyle versus a high, intense labor lifestyle or job can play a role as well. But I do see you have patients that were 110 pounds and had a desk job their whole life, and they come in at age 55 and they have horrible arthritis. Mm-hmm. And you have the patients that are obese that, you know, played football and their knees look great. So there's definitely a genetic component that none of us can control. It's just we have to blame our parents.
Right. So, well, and do you sometimes ask then about the family history?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so people listening today, if they had parents or grandparents that had these issues, then it increases their risk.
Yeah, it's something you think about. I mean, some patients, I'll tell them they didn't know when they come in for knee pain at age 50 or 55, and I'll look at the x-ray and say, you know, you have a lot of arthritis, and this is a pretty significant amount. And they'll, sure enough, we'll talk, and they'll say, my dad had both of his knees replaced at an early age. So you find there's a trend. It's not a direct one, you know, right, a direct genetic link, but there's no doubt there are trends in families.
So osteoarthritis tends to appear in what parts of the body? I guess knees?
Knees, the weight-bearing joint's obviously big. So hips and knees as far as probably the
and most common.
Most common, I mean, ankles, the feet. You can see osteoarthritis.
Fingers?
Absolutely. The fingers, and you can see how when people become older, they get the little nodules
in
the finger
bumps,
joints, and
yep,
then the fingers
that's what
can
that is. Yeah.
Sometimes yeah, related to osteoarthritis, and the fingers can even become a little crooked, the mm-hmm, tips of them.
I've seen that, yeah.
So that's all very, very common with hand arthritis, and that's a whole nother topic as far as the hand issues.
So what are the methods of treatment for osteoarthritis, and is there anything new coming along?
So, you know, when I see a patient that has osteoarthritis, I mean, we don't just dive in. I don't just say, you know, all right, you need a knee replacement, let's sign you up. And we no matter what their age or their health, you kind of want to run through the people want to avoid surgery. I mean, most people do, at least. And starting off with the conservative or the non-surgical treatment, we start with that, which can be just as simple as saying, okay, let's start a little home exercise program and maybe some over-the-counter anti-inflammatories like Aleve or ibuprofen, if their doctor is okay with that, their primary doctor is okay with that. And sometimes that'll put aside a flare-up and patients will do great for a while. And, you know, if they come back or if patients would say, well, I tried that already, what's the next thing? And then you get into maybe things like, well, a formal physical therapy program. Mm-hmm. Maybe you then talk about a little neoprene knee brace or things like that. And then you get into the injections. Then there, you know, that's the cortisone injections. There's the gel injections, which is like the Synvisc or the Monovisc. And there's a lot of different brands that sell the gel injections. And then you have kind of the newer regenerative type injections, the stem cells. And
well, let's take those one at a time. On the cortisone, mm-hmm, I've had people tell me that they've had cortisone injections and they were just incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they seem to last a long time, even as much as a year plus.
Absolutely.
And then others who say, you know,
didn't he's work, smiling because
yeah,
I think he's heard this.
Doc, it didn't. It gave me no, 1 hour of relief. That's it.
Is
or
there
no
any
relief.
Way to predict whether it's going to work for a particular person?
I mean, I have tried to figure it out, and it is. I have had patients that are just totally bone on bone, where their X-rays look so bad, and they come in and they get a shot every 6 months, and I'm like, wow, this is just. If you can do this a shot twice a year, that's great. And I have patients that have, you know, some arthritis, but not horrible, and they get a shot and it lasts for 2 weeks. There's so many variables, the patient's pain receptors and how they can handle the pain, and just, you know, and everybody's just has different, levels of what they can take. But you can't, it's hard to predict. It truthfully is. I mean, I always say it's a good thing to try. It's easy, it's cheap, it's quick. And there's only really an upside. It's the doing a cortisone shot one time is a pretty safe thing to do, assuming the patient doesn't have out of control diabetic issues, blood sugars or high blood pressure, things like that. And there are certain things you want to ask them before you do a cortisone shot, but for the most part, people can have a cortisone fairly safely.
Okay, we're talking with Dr. Andrew Spitzfaden, an orthopedic surgeon. So you mentioned also an alternative might be these gels that are injected. What is that?
So the gel injections, there's different companies that make it, but basically the gel is a little thicker than like a cortisone injection. It goes in the same way. You kind of numb up a spot on the knee. The gel is made up of kind of the normal cellular components of the joint fluid. So it's a couple of the brands are created from actually rooster combs. So patient, which
rooster
is
comb?
Rooster combs, yes. So we actually ask patients if they have an egg allergy. So it's interesting. I'm not really sure how they came about, but that's where they get some of the chemicals that go into the Jell-O shots. Not Jell-O shots. And then the thought is that insurance does cover it, which is nice. They'll pay for it every 6 months, and the thought is that it can last longer than a cortisone shot.
You can do it unlimited a number of times, unlike cortisone.
You can. I mean, you can do that twice a year if patients get a good result. And I've got a lot of patients that come in twice a year for their gel shots, and they do well. Now, the studies have shown that the patients with more advanced osteoarthritis, where it's really bone on bone, the chances of the gel working any more than cortisone are not much.
It's not replacing the cartilage.
It's the purpose of these again is pain relief. It's an anti-inflammatory effect. It's not making people think, oh, I've got the gel in there. It's going to give me
padding.
You know, it's not like you're injecting padding in there. It's all about that the gel maybe is thicker. Maybe it'll kind of stay in there longer and provide a longer anti-inflammatory relief. But that's the point.
And I guess though, for people who may not be a candidate for the knee surgeries. Or maybe it's something other than the knees, then, you know, there's just not a solution other than this, I wouldn't think, unless you, for example, the person whose hands they're having problems with or in their feet. How do you deal with that if these don't work, given that you can't replace, I guess, those items, those digits?
I mean, like the finger, you know, there are some specialty little surgeries that can be done for fingers and the feet, and you can do fusions and things like that, which actually just gets rid of the joint, and that's all. But yes, they're not as commonly done. There are different creams that you can put on the hands that are actually anti-inflammatory creams that work a little better than if you put it on your knee, because the finger joints are smaller and they're right there. But yeah, it's a frustrating problem. A lot of people have issues with their hands, and you can't get every little joint replaced, you know, and actually function. There are some joints that can be replaced in the hands that hand surgeons are doing, but it's not as common as the knees and the hips, though.
And what about with back?
There are things that can be done as far as
osteoarthritis,
because, you know, that's any place where there's cartilage, there's, you know, you can have it. The back surgeons will usually start off with, you know, therapy, cortisone. Then they have more advanced surgeries. You hear about the fusions, mm-hmm. Which is a tough surgery. And again, I don't do those, so I don't want to speak for everything about that. But there are things I think on the horizon with some of the back things, disc replacement type things that can be done, but
the artificial discs hear about that may lie on the horizon.
I mean, you know, so they, and that's, that can be pain, back pain is, that's a whole nother it's a whole nother talk, but in the sense of that's overwhelming for a lot of people, and it's there's stimulators that can be placed in patients' backs that actually, you have a little battery pack that's actually under the skin that actually provides little I guess it helps with the pain. It deals mm-hmm. with the pain receptors in the back. So there's back pain is a major issue, but a lot of that's related to osteoarthritis.
So, Dr. Spitzfaden, you're an orthopedic surgeon. Does that include back surgery as well? I was under the impression sometimes neurosurgeons also are involved with back pain.
Yeah. So basically, in orthopedic training, we every orthopedic resident spends X number of months on these learning spine surgery, because doing spine surgery type stuff. If you wanted to do spine surgery as a career, you would do a fellowship designated in orthopedic spine surgery, or you can do spine surgery via the neurosurgery route. So spine surgeons can either be orthopedic surgeons or neurosurgeons. But if you come out and you're doing sports, you know, orthopedics, and you go to the sports route, or you're doing general orthopedics, you're not going to be operating on backs. Mm. We can manage back pain and order MRIs and start therapy. But if I find something that's not, you know, not working in patients or have a surgical problem, I get them to our spine partners at St. Luke's.
So just for our listeners' benefit, so if they have spine issues, then they would focus on an orthopedic surgeon or a neurosurgeon who would be essentially exclusively focused on back issues.
Yeah, they deal with the spine.
And it's a subspecialty.
Yes, it's a branch. I mean, it's, yes. So there are groups in town that they deal just with backs, spine surgeons, and they can be neuro or orthopedic.
You mentioned some stem cell replacements or stem cell research. What's on the horizon with that, and are we close to that?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, a lot of the stem cell regenerative type medicine. It's a hot topic, and it's been around for a while. So, you know, basically that involves, the stem cells can help tissues heal, maybe like, you know, a tendons and like rotator cuffs. So there's been some good studies that have shown assistance with tendon healing if you have a rotator cuff tear and things like that. But then there's also been, does stem cell injections, and there's different kinds, can that help in the role of managing osteoarthritis type pain?
Generating cell growth.
Yeah, it helps with basically, and they don't exactly know how it has its effects, but a lot of that has to do with the anti-inflammatory effect that can last longer. The cells in there can kind of help with inflammation and help with pain. There is some thought, can it help regrow some cartilage? And there are some studies that show good success, but if you have global arthritis, where like what I've been talking about with just bone on bone and all over, it's not just going to give you a knee that, it's not going to give you a joint that looks like it did when you were a teenager. The effects usually are going to be because it helps with the inflammation. And the thought is, and some of the early maybe studies or early papers have said that can give patients longer relief than like cortisone. So, you know, you can do it from the bone marrow, where patients can, you know, you can have your bone marrow, you know, taken from your pelvic bone, or you can get it from fat, where you have fat taken a little like a mini liposuction, I call it, kind of from around your belly area. And it's not a surgical procedure. You come right to the office and you lay right there, and then that's done. And then those cells are injected into the knee, and it doesn't work instantly like cortisone, but it can develop and allow for pain relief over maybe anywhere from 6 to 12 weeks.
So this is using your own stem cells?
Your own stem cells, yes. Like, there are donor stem cells as well, which is a whole other thing. But, you know, if patients can donate their own, that's your own tissue. It's very safe. There's really no downside.
Rejection or anything like that
with
that.
It's very safe.
So I guess I would have loved to have heard that it can generate fresh growth, like cell growth and whatnot, which was what I thought was the exciting thing about.
I guess it can, but I guess the effects of where patients see the pain relief is not because their cartilage is, the cushion is not regrowing, and then they're like, oh, I feel better because I've got, look at my new x-ray, it looks great. It's more that they're feeling better because the anti-inflammatory healing response. The growth part, there are, and this is a whole field, but doing the stem cell type stuff can heal small little areas of or small defects or tendon tears and things like that. So it can definitely promote healing and regrowth, but it's just how much can it do in a knee with bad arthritis, I think, is still unknown. And so I try not to tell my patients that, because I think it gives a little bit of false hope and makes them think, oh yeah, I'm gonna have a beautiful new knee. I try to, you know,
Be realistic.
Yeah, it's a good, yeah. Be realistic with them so they kind of understand. Because some patients, it doesn't work. And, you know, I find that the ones that have complete bone on bone, where it's with deformity and bad arthritis, that maybe the chances of it working are not as good. But most patients are very happy that they tried it because they just don't want to have surgery and won't have surgery.
Yeah, yeah. Is that very common that people just say, I won't have surgery?
Yeah, I have patients that come in sometimes for their cortisone shot every 3 months. I have some that are in their mid-80s, upper 80s, and, you know, even, like I said, it's not based on their number of age, but their heart issues, and they're just not candidates. And, you know, they might get a month or two relief of the cortisone, and, you know, they don't want to do the stem cells, so they come in for their three to four months.
And some people just have a fear of surgery.
Absolutely. And I mean, even younger patients can too. Yeah. And I mean, personally, I probably would be too. I mean, I even know that how well patients can do. But, you know, if my own parent asked me, you know, had a problem with their knees, I mean, I would say, I would make sure they've done what we've talked about, some of the conservative, but I would be in full support of my own family member having a knee or hip replacement, because I think, you know, they're overall very successful surgeries.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that.
But they are scary, no doubt.
Yeah.
Well, sure, nobody likes to just say, oh, gee, especially if it's elective. I mean, it's one thing if you're in pain and you know that this is going to help me get out of pain, but it's like when you have a knee, you just kind of hobble along with it. And
Some people,
it's amazing that how much we're willing to just compromise our lives, just, oh, well, it's okay. Or, I've seen it all over the place.
Yeah.
And that frustrates me is when... and I've seen this a little bit with my family in some cases, where there is a surgical solution that seems very reasonable and seems very safe, mm-hmm. and yet it's difficult to, you know, to persuade maybe a family member. And you don't want to push too hard because, heaven forbid, they have
something,
a surgery,
right,
and something terrible goes wrong.
And that's exactly right. And that's why when I do see a patient, I say it's not up to me to tell you you have to have a knee replacement. I tell them that you would be a candidate when you are ready. And I say you will wave the white flag and say, and they may call. They may come back in 3 days later or maybe 2 years later, and they might say, I'm ready for it, both physically and mentally. But some patients just aren't, they're not there, and they may not ever be there.
Well, and some patients, I think there's a little bit of a fear. I've known people that have had both knees replaced, or mm-hmm. they need to have both knees replaced.
Oh, yeah.
And so they feel like they get through one, and then it's like, I just have to go have the other one done in a year from now. And
yeah.
So they're looking almost long-term at, I'm not going to be doing anything for 2 or 3 years, and it's just not worth it to them, maybe, or something.
Yeah. There's a lot. They don't want to miss certain, I mean, you know, everybody, there's any reason you can think of, it's their common reasons. I mean, time of year, downtime. All those things, which, you know, I can understand.
Yeah, and I know that your position, coming from the perspective of a physician, is that a surgeon especially, is that you don't want to appear to be pushing your services, and as a lawyer who, when I'm talking to people about estate planning issues, or I'm talking to them about you know, qualifying perhaps for long-term care, You know that they want you to be frank with them and give them the best advice you can. And often I'll have the opinion that, look, what you ought to do, I'm thinking this, I'm probably not saying this, rarely am I saying this, what you ought to do is pay me to go ahead and form this irrevocable trust, because that's going to work to such and such, and that will qualify. In other words, it's something I firmly believe, and it has nothing to do with the fact that I'm being paid, that I firmly believe that. Mm-hmm. But yet I'm inhibited in saying that because it appears mercenary.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so instead I become more detached.
Yes.
And unfortunately, by becoming more detached, you're really, you and I both would not be delivering as good a service as if you felt liberated to say, look, Mr. Smith, yeah, there is a risk that you could die on the table in a surgery.
Right.
But I can tell you that I think what you ought to do is go ahead and have this surgery done. You're 65. You're in good health. This knee will last you for, in all likelihood, 15, maybe 25 years. It's what makes sense. And I really think this is what you ought to do. You probably don't feel comfortable saying that, do you?
It depends. I have to feel the patients out. If a patient, you know, kind of is, I'm looking, it's almost like they want me to, and you just learn how your patients, you know, then I will say, you know, I think
that's what
I think
want.
It's a good call for you. I think you will do well with this. And I always use my own family as an example. I say, if my own father came to me or my mother, I would say the same thing. And I think patients like to hear that. But
they do.
If I come in and just say, nice to meet you, Dr. Spitzfaden, your x-rays, you got horrible bone on bone. You need to have a knee replacement. And they jump out of their seat. Well, what are you talking about, knee replacement? I don't even know, I have arthritis. And you're like, well, that's just all we can do. You need to do it. It works great. You know, that would not be a good approach. And I could scare a lot of patients off. So you kind of have to.
You have to use discretion. We're running
yes.
out of time here. But I kind of like to close on this point, because I think that doctors, more so than lawyers, I think that doctors have this real reluctance to step out there mm-hmm. and to say, this is what I recommend. Now, I realize you guys get sued a lot.
I was going to say, it's
right.
the lawyers that are doing that.
Look, I'm one of the lawyers.
I'm just the radio person.
But I'm on the side of the fence where you know, I'm like doctors and business people. You know, personal injury lawyers to me mean lawsuits against me or my business or my employees. So I get that, and I come from that perspective. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I think that patients really want, and clients of lawyers really want, they want a professional who will step forward and give them, tell them their heart on the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's risky.
Yeah.
And all too often what lawyers do, and I have employees who will do this, and I always speak out against this when we're having having firm meetings, is some will say, look, what I do is I tell them what their options are. I make sure I've explained them their options, and they have to make the decision. To which I want to step in and say, no.
Yeah, no, right.
You want to do more than that.
I do. I want to say the same thing.
Yeah, you want to give them their options,
yeah.
Of course.
Yes.
But and then if that maybe that is all they want, you'll have a few, as you suggested, you have a few patients who feel that way.
Yes.
But I think many patients are like me and you, Aunt Susan, in that we really want the doctor to take that extra step and say, look, this is what I would do if I were in your shoes.
Yeah, and that's sometimes what you can do that, yeah.
And it means a lot, but it's risky. And
it is, yeah, you got to feel them out.
Okay, with us today is Dr. Spitz Fadden. We'll be back in a moment with Elder Talk.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors. Presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA, Joe Cordell.
Okay, we're back with Elder Talk. With us this week is Dr. Andrew Spitz Fadden, an orthopedic surgeon. So many issues we can talk about. It seems like as we age, you know, we have various physical problems, but bone issues, especially knees and hips. You know, if you line up 10 people who are over 60, especially over 70, they can fill an hour of conversation about this topic. So we knew it would be very popular. Let me throw a couple things at you. There are kind of phrases that I hear mentioned a lot in association with knee and hips, perhaps, is talk a little bit about kind of the role of the MRI. And often that is suggested when someone comes in. Help people understand what that is and why it's important.
So, yeah, an MRI, most people know what an MRI is, and a lot of people have had an MRI. So when a patient first comes into the office, if they have knee pain, the first thing you do is you get an x-ray. You want to kind of assess if there's anything obvious on the x-ray, bone lesions, or maybe there's bad things like a tumor or a fracture or something like that. And if they have arthritis, you can see that on the x-ray. If they have minimal osteoarthritis and they still have pretty significant pain, maybe had an injury, maybe did not have an injury, that's when we think about, okay, what's another test to possibly do to better assess the cartilage and the ligaments of the knee? And that would be an MRI. It's a test that it looks at bone and can look for stress fractures, but it also can look at the meniscus and the ligaments in the knee. So it can give us a good idea if there would be a tear that could be causing the pain, because the x-ray kind of ruled out that it was an osteoarthritis problem. And so that's when we get an MRI.
So the x-ray would tell you whether or not there was osteoarthritis.
Yes, that's the best test. So we don't need an MRI or a blood test or anything to diagnose osteoarthritis. I mean, an MRI will show some osteoarthritis, but with an x-ray, you can see what you need to see based on the amount of space that's left between the bones.
So when you've ruled that out, the x-ray's been done, then as you just described, the MRI would be done, and the various things that can reveal, are those often more difficult to fix? Or
a lot of times, if it's a meniscus tear, a straightforward kind of cartilage tear, it's definitely a lot easier to deal with that than it would be if you had, you know, a bad fracture or a bad arthritis or osteoarthritis that would possibly require a joint replacement. So there's the treatments for a small meniscus tear or any kind of cartilage tear, maybe something, it could still be a surgery, but would maybe involve what we call a knee arthroscopy or a knee scope, which many people out there have had. Even as a teenager, you may have had one. But we can do knee scopes in patients in their 60s, 70s, treated for a tear.
Yeah, a lot of us have heard the phrase scope.
Scope,
so,
yes.
Yeah, explain what that is for those who don't know what it is.
So arthroscopy and scope, same thing. So a scope basically is where a patient comes into the operating room. It's an outpatient procedure. You're put to sleep, so it is a general anesthetic, and usually anywhere from 2 or 3 small little 1 centimeter or smaller poke holes are made around the knee, and the knee is inflated with fluid, so you kind of blow the knee up. The knee itself is a contained space, so that it provides pressure in the knee with fluid, so that then you can put a camera in and you can look around the knee. And now with the technology, with HD cameras, I mean, the pictures are unbelievable, and you can see things in just wonderful detail. And you can look for the tear, and we have special instruments that can just snip off the bad edges of a tear, kind of like a hangnail on a finger almost. I mean, you kind of just can get rid of the annoying, or the culprit, I should say.
So it can be fixed with the scope. The scope is not just a diagnostic, you can actually go in at that time when you see what the issue is and fix it then
True.
And there.
Absolutely. I mean, there's the knee arthroscopy or knee scopes. We can do, you know, ligament reconstructions. We can do cartilage cleanups type deal. a diagnostic knee scope could be used if a patient, for instance, cannot have an MRI, like if they have a pacemaker or some other kind of an implant that doesn't allow them to have an MRI, and they are just having continued pain, and the x-rays look good, then you could say, well, you know what, there's probably a tear in there, let's do a diagnostic scope. But even in there, you're ready to go to fix whatever you would find.
And often that is what happens with scopes.
Absolutely. And you can get in there, and even the MRI doesn't show everything. You know, there's two meniscus or menisci in the knee, and you might on the MRI see a medial meniscus tear, but then you get into the knee, and sure enough, there's a lateral meniscus tear as well, or maybe another little cartilage defect. So you kind of do a full, you know, inspection of the knee.
So now how does this person's feel when they wake up? Is their knee incredibly sore?
I mean, I personally have had one, so I can. This is one of those things I can tell patients. I understand. We use numbing medicine to try to numb it up, and the anesthesiologist, you know, have pain medicine, so you wake up. And I was fairly comfortable. Most patients are comfortable. Yes, it does become a little sore for the first few days, but patients are up walking on the knee or walking on the leg, moving it. Usually, by a few weeks, feeling even better. 6 weeks, you should be feeling pretty good. And depending on how much you have to do, and again, that's doing a knee scope on a 18-year-old versus a 60-year-old, where you might be doing more work, is different. But yeah, patients are moving. I mean, it's not like you're downtime.
This has been Joe Cordell and Dr. Andrew Spitzfaden, and another episode of Elder Talk. We look forward to you joining us next week. Till then, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. That's eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.